This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm here with Larissa McFarker, a longtime staff writer for the magazine. Larissa, you worked a long time on a story about the difficulties of leaving an extremely tight-knit religious community, specifically when a person wants to leave the community and divorce their spouse. What led you to want to look into this?
Well, the religious community you're referring to is what's often called the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, though they call themselves Haredi, which is H-A-R-E-D-I. And so what drew me to it is the impossibility of the situation where you have one parent who is more or less secular and another parent who is still a member of an ultra-Orthodox or Haredi community. And a court somehow has to figure out how their children are going to be raised. And I wanted to look into it because I just could not imagine how to figure this out when the norms and the beliefs of these two ways of life are really irreconcilable.
You spoke to three different people for this piece in depth. Tell me about them.
So I spoke to a couple of lawyers who deal with these custody cases between one secular parent and one religious parent. But first I spoke to Hani Getter. And she grew up in Rockland County, which is about 25 miles northwest of New York City. And her family is very religious. She was not one of these kids who rebelled at an early age. She loved her religion, she loved her family, and she loved her whole world.
I grew up with so much joy, so much singing. We were a pious group of people, putting God before anything else. God was an intimate friend and was someone you connected with really deeply. And that's a beautiful thing, to have that kind of connection and that kind of joy, that kind of grounding where the world is so difficult, but you have this beautiful love that surrounds you all the time.
When you were married in an arranged marriage when you were 18. Did you expect to be happy as a married woman?
I didn't grow up with fairy tales. I didn't expect it to be happily ever after. I expected to be able to build a beautiful home with someone else. As in all communities, we have unwritten rules about what happens. And the unwritten promise in the community is that you'll get married and you'll build a life and you'll have peace, and both of you will work towards creating a beautiful home for God and find a way to work together and be together, and happiness will come from that.
And that didn't happen.
Not for me.
In the community Honey grew up in, modesty is very important. And one of the traditions is the morning after a woman's wedding, her mother comes and shaves off her hair.
I know it sounds so vain in some way, but I had had long hair my entire life. I have very thick hair, and it means something. And the night before I think both of us, my ex and I, had a traumatic experience in terms of what happened with the sex. I can't speak for him, but I would venture to guess that it was not pleasant. Neither of us really knew what we were doing. And the next morning, after the most intimate act you can do with another person, especially someone you don't know, and it's terrifying, my mother showed up with clippers and shaved my head off, and I felt like my entire identity was gone. And as I'm telling you the story, I'm thinking about an ex-sister-in-law of mine who tells the same story and how she loved that her mother came and shaved her hair. And then she started wearing a wig because she hated her uncontrollable hair, right? So as I tell you my trauma, the same thing happens to another person and they're grateful and excited. It's not a one-way thing, these rituals and the way that they impact us.
And when did you find out or begin to get language for the idea that you were gay?
That's a wonderful question. Like, when did I start having language about being gay? After I had my second child, I was having physical...
Honey issues. Told me a story that during her second pregnancy, she was essentially put on bed rest, and her husband bought a television, which was not really allowed in their community. This was around the time that Ellen DeGeneres had come out. When Hani's husband came home, she talked to him about it.
I said to him, you know, I think I'm a lesbian. And he said, what's that? And I explained that it's a woman who's attracted to women. And he said, yeah, of course you are. And we continued on our day as if nothing happened and we had another child.
Now, why was this not a bigger deal in your marriage?
Because we didn't know it could be. Just because I was attracted to people, that didn't mean that I could live a life like that. I hadn't figured that piece out. And there's something about growing up in a religious community where there are no love stories, where you don't see physical contact between men and women, that made it totally okay in my mind for me to be gay. Because I really believed that women were attracted to women and got married to men to have children. I didn't know any other way. Nobody spoke about attraction, and so it never occurred to me that men were actually attracted to women or vice versa. For me, living in a community and lying about who I was not going to work. There are so many people that I know who are gay or lesbian within the community and have their dalliances outside and then stay because it's so complicated to leave. But for some of us, living authentic is more important than belonging in a community.
Hani Gedder was 23 years old and the mother by then already of three kids when she decided that her life had to change. What happened within her and what was the process of trying to leave like?
Well, it actually took her a few years before she left the community. The first thing she did was leave her marriage and go into therapy. And this is the other thing. Hani got divorced around 20 years ago, and that's part of why she's able to talk to us, because her kids are grown. Whereas people who are in the middle of custody cases now, they can get incredibly contentious and traumatic. I spoke to a lawyer who's negotiated more than 700 of these cases.
Yeah, I have my iPhone recording.
His name is Joel Yacoub.
I definitely find that religious divorces are more emotionally involved because when you're contacted by a client, you're never contacted by a person by themselves. You're going to have their rabbi involved. You're going to have brothers-in-law, their father, and you feel that pressure because the whole community wants to know what's happening in the case. But when you're successful, you get that reward as well.
Joel Yacoub more often represents the religious partner. He spoke to me from his office. So what are some of the differences between a divorce in an ultra-Orthodox community and a secular divorce?
The level of detail that you have to address in a religious divorce versus a secular divorce. Everything from the style of headdress that a man or boy wears upon reaching bar mitzvah, to the length of his payas, to how far a girl's skirt would be. Does she wear stockings? Are they clear stockings, not clear stockings? To the curriculum in a school. Plus you have the fact that there's a Jewish holiday every month of the year except for 1 month. And so you have an agreement that can be so much more complex than a regular secular divorce.
It's interesting. I've seen that a lot of the time courts may side with the religious parent, even though the courts are secular, because they value stability in the children's lives. Why do you think they side so often with the religious parent?
It's an easier sell to a judge to say, look, child's 2 years old. I'm going this way. She's going that way. We need to find a middle ground where we can both be in that child's life, right? I think that's an easier case. But once you get to, you know, I've got four kids. They're all over the age of eight now, you know, and they're semi-teenagers. And their entire life being and peer group is in this community. Judges recognize divorce is so destabilizing for children. And the last thing that they're going to do is kind of allow one parent to just jolt that even more.
One of the things I'm wondering about is how it seems like the courts do sometimes seem to value stability so much in the child's life that they value it more than the relationship with the second parent, the second parent being the one who's moved away from the community, that become more secular, the one who threatens the stability of their life as it's been to that point. Does that seem right to you?
I put the onus on the parent. That's really the way I view it. It's not about the parent at all. It's about the kid. So if you feel, I'm giving an example, that it's so important to take a child to a gay pride parade because of the way it makes you feel and how you perceive it's going to affect, you know, maybe the way this child's going to have a world view. I think in certain cases, that's a reckless act. And I think in certain cases, that's a beautiful act. It really depends on the circumstances.
So you can see how much is at stake in this argument. If you're an LGBTQ parent or a secular parent, Joel is saying that your values might be distressing and confusing to your child because they conflict so totally with the religious values the child has been raised with and which his other parent still believes in.
To me, it's not about like an issue of expression that this parent is no longer allowed to express themselves the way that they want. I think a parent, you know, when I have children, there's so many things we give up, you know, including our sleep to, you know, our time. It's one of the sacrifices you make. And they're in an unfortunate position, but I think you just have to give some care in thinking about not what would make you most happy, but what would kind of work for the child.
Losing sleep is one thing for your kids, and we all do that. But I think losing your constitutional rights is a bridge too far, and it's one that the courts won't make you do.
That's Julie Kay. She is a legal strategist for Footsteps, which is an organization that helps people who are leaving or pulling away from Hasidic communities.
I've had, you know, attorneys for the children, others say to me, well, you know, this would all go away if your client would just go back in the closet. A wise psychiatrist who specializes in contested divorces once told me, you know, children are made of rubber, not glass, and that it's important for them to be able to learn to navigate these spaces with loving and cooperating parents on both sides. And I think, you know, what I would say is that the ultra-Orthodox community has to start to embrace these families more.
Larissa, so what do you make of all this? It sounds like both lawyers pretty much agree that everyone should be looking out for the children. So what's the issue here?
Well, the issue is that they're, of course, very different ideas about what's good for the children, right? And the question is, how do they reconcile these really irreconcilable worlds? And honestly, I think that both sides underestimate how hard it is to do. So Joel believes that Footsteps does really great work in providing its members with emotional support. But now that it's also hiring lawyers to litigate these custody cases, he thinks they're creating more problems.
I think when they have gone and really petitioned so many, you know, large law firms to do pro bono work, it's with the pitch that this is about, you know, freedoms, rights for transgendered, rights for gay rights. And I think that's where I kind of think that they're off in their approach, because it's about the children It's not about individual rights. If you were seeing courts not respect the rights of parents who are gay or transgendered, absolutely bring in the big law firms and let's establish the right, you know, of them as parents. But we have those rights, and those rights are never trampled on.
This is true. The courts have not technically denied custody to an LGBTQ parent or a secular parent. But the question is what those parents can do around their children and how they raise them. Whether or not the secular parent has to pretend to go along with religious rules that they no longer believe in. A few years ago, the norm was to ask the secular parent to basically just fake it, to pretend while they were their kids that they're still religious. But there was a big case in 2017, the Weisberger case, that changed that standard. In Weisberger, basically, the court said that the secular parent did not have to lie about who she was. But it did require her to make sure that her children continued to follow religious rules. So what Julie wants to establish in the future is that forcing secular parents to monitor their kids' religious observance is really not all that different from forcing them to be observant themselves.
It turns the parent into a religious nanny or a religious cop, that he now has to make sure that his children are following religious norms that he himself doesn't have a deep-seated belief in. I think that really starts to interfere with having an authentic parenting relationship.
You might think that the way to solve these problems would be just for the two parents to tolerate each other's worldviews and that the kids should just go back and forth. But if you belong to a religious minority, you might see it very differently. Here's the way Joel sees it.
I think you have to realize that the religious parent is probably more on the defense than the offense, because everything that a more secular parent wants to expose their child to is generally something enjoyable. It's not like the secular parent saying, you're going to sit and do 10 hours of, you know, secular studies and learn American history. It's you're going to get to watch YouTube, get to use an iPhone, go and play in, you know, a secular swimming pool with mixed gender. And most of their community is built around shielding themselves from those things so that they don't succumb to the desire.
You know, I'm not sure I completely agree with Joel here. I mean, I understand that it can seem like iPhones and YouTube are irresistible, and I'm sure to some kids they are. And of course, many people have left religious communities of all kinds because of the lure of secular life. But in fact, the pull on the religious side is also very, very strong. It's everyone and everything the child has ever known. It's their whole world. So this is really the tragedy of divorces of this kind, where one parent is secular and one is religious. It's not like with a secular divorce where the parents might have slightly different rules or badmouth each other. It's a situation where you're going from one parent who says something is fun and normal to another parent who says it's a violation of the laws of God. And even if a court grants both parents partial custody, it's just very hard to imagine how a child makes sense of that without ultimately rejecting one parent or the other.
You can read Larissa McFarker's piece about the organization Footsteps at NewYorker.com.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.